This week's After Dinner speaker is our transitional engineer, Susan Krumdiek. She's on the line now. Kia ora, Suzanne.
Kia ora, Brian.
Now, the last time we had you on was just before lockdown, and you will remember you talked about COVID-19, the pandemic, which might just help to save us from ourselves. And I wonder how you view what's happened since.
Well, we've definitely had a major disruption, that's for sure. I think the disruption changes things, but it doesn't solve anything. So we've still got all the work to do that we had to do before, but now we've been woken up a bit.
I mean, you would have seen, just as I have seen, and anybody else listening would have seen, the drop in traffic congestion. We would have read about the drop in CO2 emissions. We would have noticed perhaps the cleaner air. We might have noticed less congestion and more people out exercising. But now, I don't know about you, but the rush was back again where I was today.
Yeah, but we've all seen it now, haven't we? We've all experienced it. And that world is out there. And it's a matter of, I guess, finding our way to creating it. And for me, all of that, the vehicles, the oil, the streets the way they are, the traffic lights the way they are, I don't know if you all understand, all of that's engineered. It doesn't have to be that way. There's many other ways. And people really have to start understanding that they've got to look under the rock and see what the engineers around the country are doing and say, look, you know, sort this out. Get to work on changing things.
When you say engineered, it almost sounds like social engineering, as in the engineering makes us this way, as opposed to the engineering being there to serve our needs. It's there because we want to do what we do, and the engineering makes that possible.
Well, people adapt to whatever works. And so if I took, a big American from Houston, Texas, who drives a giant vehicle 45 miles to work each day, and he went over for a 3-month stint in Amsterdam, he wouldn't drive 45 miles each day in a giant vehicle. He would adapt to what works in Amsterdam. Yeah? So all I'm saying is that both of those systems are engineered. They both have what they have, and it is made to work by people called engineers. And so there's an infinite number of ways that things can work, and people will figure out how to use what works.
So tell me a bit again about transition engineering, which is how I introduced you, and we've discussed this before in previous chats.
Right. The basic premise is that there's a difference, there's a gap between what we know how to do and what we've already gotten good at doing, and what we're going to be in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. So what we know for sure is that the future isn't going to be an extrapolation of the past. We're now in a transition period where we figure out new things and better ways to do things that use much less oil and coal and gas, and therefore produce much less emissions, but that can also be better in a lot of ways. So the systems that we use now that produce all of those emissions and all the traffic deaths and all the pollution will need to be changed, and those changes have to be engineered. And so this field of transition engineering is really taking off. We have a book now published, which actually is pretty accessible to be read by non-engineers so that you can tell what we're doing. And we have, since we talked last, we've launched an online class for professional engineers to pick up these new ideas pretty quickly. And that's now up over 80 people without any advertising. And we have come up with some pretty clever things already and started a new cooperative consultancy called Transition HQ. So we have been really busy.
Transitioning from engineering that relies on internal combustion, on the burning of fossil fuels, to get us where we want to go or to get us what we need, to engineering which uses energy which doesn't emit fossil fuels. Right?
Something like that. Let's understand that the only way to change things in a way that 100 years from now that way still works because we were right and it wasn't temporary is to look at the whole system. So it isn't just the energy that you put in a car. It's the way the land is used in your city. It's the way that your freight moves around. It's the way that houses are located near the activities people want to go to. It's about how much of the land in your city is dedicated just to the motion of cars or the parking of cars. And so if you start to look at things as whole systems, you start to understand that, you know, we've solved this problem about 10,000 different ways, and the one we're looking at right now isn't the way that it has to be. We can actually do things different. And so it isn't just one thing, like which fuel you use. It's, you know, between now and 100 years from now, most of the houses that we're living in are going to have to be rebuilt. And so let's make sure we rebuild them in the right place and so that they last for hundreds of years and so that people can get where they want to go with cycles and by walking.
Tell me about some of the ideas, the good ideas that you and fellow engineers have been coming up with over the past couple of months.
Well, I think probably one of the best ideas is to look at how we take our old houses that are not insulated well and not comfortable and use too much energy, even though you aren't really comfortable. And what does the whole project look like of building New Zealand through that, right? If you imagine that we've got this sort of wilderness of homes that really can't make it too much longer, they don't serve our needs properly. And we're going to go into that wilderness essentially and redevelop it into the cities of the future. Then the business to do that is actually the novel thing. We already know how to build dwellings for people that are super comfortable and very low energy. My house that I'm sitting in right now, I did this last year, basically as a kind of action research project where I took my old house and I redeveloped it into a house of the future. And we haven't had the heat on yet today, and we're still about 18 degrees inside. So it is actually possible to do that. That's not the question. It's what does the business and the economics and look like, and how do you not leave people behind? And so that business is one of our innovations.
Which brings me to the question of how do you provide people with an incentive to make change, which might initially seem quite expensive, without putting a price, a greater price, on the burning of fossil fuels than we currently put. And remember that at the moment, because of this COVID-19 economic downturn, the price of crude oil has collapsed. So fossil fuels are going to be quite cheap for a bit, aren't they?
Oh, the fossil fuel industry, I don't know if you remember, it wasn't that long ago, we had $140 a barrel oil, and then the industry reacts to that, this cheap situation is probably going to collapse some of the producers, and then we're going to swing around some more. And basically, my favorite transition engineering project of all time is to set up a consortium of researchers to work with the oil industry to essentially understand that the resource we're talking about, oil, is probably the most valuable energy resource that there will ever be. It is all we've got, and we can't afford to use most of it. Therefore, it's an extremely valuable thing. And so we change the whole economics of oil to where you produce a small amount of it for hundreds of years. And I think that would actually be a much better economic position for the oil industry than what they've been doing for the last 50 years, which hasn't really been working out that well for them.
It sounds, however, that that is a political and economic, probably even a political debate rather than an engineering thing, persuading the oil companies to decide, right, what we have now is extremely precious, and yes, we can only afford to burn a little bit of this, so as you say, we should put it into a high value use. What are the high, I guess, what are the highest value uses you think for oil?
Well, what's essential? That's one of our tenets, that we look at what's actually essential for well-being. And so probably the most obvious one is food and water. Yeah. We don't actually use, okay, we use a lot of oil to produce our food, but compared to the other things we use oil for, it's not actually that big. And then you have emergency response. We've got a lot of dealing with climate change emergencies to do now into the future. And so we need that response. And from there, basically, we think just about everything else can be re-engineered so that we don't need the oil.
I remember last time we spoke, and it might even been the time before, Susan, you talked about the problem of consumption, that also the society we live in at the moment is a bit addicted to either buying things that involve escape. So we purchase travel so we can go somewhere, and that burns a lot of fossil fuel, or we just buy stuff. And you seen, when I asked you that then, whether it was just a case of if we did this using renewable energy, non-fossil fuel energy, wouldn't that be solving our problem? And you weren't convinced about that. You argued that consumption itself is a bit of a problem. You still feel that way now?
Yes. And the other thing is that it really isn't true that we can substitute renewable energy for fossil energy, all right? We all just need to get our head around that.
Yes, that's right. And I remember you saying that.
Not how that works. Yes. Number one, you have to have fossil energy to manufacture and to deploy and to build any of those renewable energy converters, and they don't last forever, so you have to go mining again and building again. And, you know, you really can't run a solar factory just with solar, and you can't make steel with wind. I mean, it's not the way it works. You can definitely use renewable energy, but not to run a fossil fuel civilization. So that whole rejigging of the whole thing, what people consume, and here again, I have a rule. I never refer to people as consumers. That is a thing that Ronald Reagan started doing in the 80s. Before that, people were fathers and mothers, they were families, they were citizens, they were doctors and lawyers and professors. Nobody referred to people as consumers. That is so insulting and horrible. We are not just consumers. And yet, man, that's how people, so I don't worry about consumption as a thing that is a right or necessary. And in fact, it may be degrading our experience of life, because we get so wrapped up just in sort of vacuous shopping. And so I think there's a way better future for us when we get a handle on the marketing that's done to us all the time, on this pushing of us to be nothing but consumers and blind consumers at that. We can do so much better. I think we'll be good.
Therefore, is this point in history the moment when we have an opportunity to make that change? Is COVID-19 a crisis that we can't afford to waste, Susan?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to have plenty of crises after this with the extreme weather situations. And so we are going to become people who are very good at managing and adapting and just really get over this thing of worrying about things not being the way that that we're used to, we're actually going to start to be really rising to the challenge, that sort of thing. And I'm pretty sure that the glimpse that we've all had of the world post-oil, we can see so many ways that it's actually better in a lot of ways, and we've wasted a huge amount of land on this project. You know, when you were out walking around in the street, did you notice how big it is and how much wasted space it is and all that metal just sitting there in the cars? Yeah.
To some extent,
exciting times ahead.
Yeah. But to some extent, what you talk of, Susan, sounds to me quite revolutionary. And there's a part of me that has strong sympathy for this approach, but there's another part of me that worries if the world economy was disrupted, well, okay, it's been disrupted right now, how much hardship that might cause some people.
Well, I mean, obviously it's going to cause hardship. What's interesting is a lot of the hardship is in industries which we're going to have to transition regardless, right? The international hop-on-a-plane tourism. Okay, now here's some more controversy for you in revolution. The whole way of life of working in whatever job you can get, like especially waiting on people, changing the beds in the hotel, just so you can pay the rent, I think we're going to be surprised that we have choices again, and that we can start thinking about what we want to do and what we can do, and just start interacting with each other in ways that make sense, and start doing a lot of our own ideas for what businesses we want to do. And I just think we're gonna be really surprised. And if we've got the engineering right behind that, so that people can actually be enabled in what they want to do, I think we'll be, like I said, I'm not actually that sure that the economy has been wrecked. I mean, where's the actual data? You know how much money we've saved in the last month by not going out and buying cars?
Yes, I do know that there are quite a few people who've lost their jobs, though.
Right. And okay, here's one more revolutionary thing. Okay, so things stopped, and therefore some people couldn't go to work and couldn't work from home, so they lost their jobs. And I'll tell you what, if the government was going to do one thing to deal with that part of the economy that is now in crisis, because it's people not being able to pay their rent and not being able to pay their loan on their car or whatever other loan they've got, then the government needs to sanction, you know, you've been out of work 12 weeks, then guess what? Your mortgage company has now been out 12 weeks. And your landlord is out 12 weeks. Why should all of the burden be put on the people who have been serving us and, you know, doing the work? We really need to move that damage up the scale. And if you look at, you know, if the landlord, if they were actually making their living off renting things, then it would move up from them if they, you know, 12 weeks that they didn't get rental income, well, 12 weeks they don't pay their mortgage, and it moves up to the banks. Well, the banks, that money they lent out, it wasn't a pile of money that was in a pocket. It wasn't actual, you know, they kind of loaned it into existence. And so it's not that economic hit, I think, is where we need to push this out a bit, and then we will all be able to get back on our feet and do what we need to do.
Susan, thank you very much for joining us again. Plenty to chew on for next time we join you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
All right.
That's,
sure.
Thanks, Suzanne. That's Susan Krumdiek, our transition engineer, always providing food for thought